I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, the founder of Maisels Films, a documentary film company. Albert has been a pioneer in the documentary film world since the 1960s. He's one of the creators, along with his brother David, of a modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. Albert, I'd love to know what year you were born.
1926. I just celebrated my 80th birthday, believe it or not, but there it is.
Do you feel 80?
Not at all. Not at all.
Where did you grow up?
Boston.
How did your parents meet? Were they Bostonians to begin with?
Oh, they met very romantically in Boston, of course. At noontime, they would meet at a street, particular street corner every day and have lunch. What my mother didn't know was that my father would arrive 5 or 10 minutes early, place himself across the street behind a window and just look at her.
Oh, wow. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother was a school teacher. In those days, in the 30s and even in the 40s, teaching in Boston was, for a woman, was restricted only to women who weren't married. And so they were all spinsters. And so my mother was married, so she couldn't teach in Boston. So we moved to Brookline, and there she found she couldn't teach because she was Jewish, and there weren't any Jewish teachers. So she had to convince the superintendent of schools that she be a teacher, and he allowed her to be what's called a permanent substitute.
So she had some moxie.
Yes. Oh, and she was very devoted to civil rights. Her one dream was to spend some time with Mrs. Roosevelt, and she did. Spent a whole day with her. Many, many years later, when I came back from my first trip to Russia, where I made a film in mental hospitals, I read in the paper that she was going to Russia. This was 1956. She was going to look into social services. She wanted to visit mental hospitals, but she had heard that there weren't any. So I called her up and told her that indeed there were. In fact, I made this film. Oh, come on over and bring your projector. So I spent a whole day, as my mother did, I spent a whole day with Mrs. Roosevelt.
And what did your dad do?
My father was a postal clerk. He should have been a musician. In fact, I have the cornet that he played. Sits in front of me on the wall where I have breakfast every morning. He never played the cornet in my lifetime, because he used to play with his brothers. He had a brother who played the violin, another one percussion, and the third one played another instrument. He died before I was born. And when he died, my father just lost the heart to play and never played anymore. But one day, I happened to bring my cornet into the office, and Wynton Marsalis was in my office to look at a film we had just put together. Of him. And as he was leaving, I thought, oh, I tell him the story of the cornet. I brought it to him right away. He started playing it. That's the only time I've heard that the cornet played by Wynton Marsalis instead of my father.
Did you feel that, do you get a sense that your father wasn't satiated with his profession as a postal clerk, or did he completely embrace it?
Well, he tried to make the best of it. And in fact, there were so few jobs during the Depression that we were lucky that we had a salary job. And he always looked forward to the pension, which he would get after 30 years of service. He died 29 years into his service, so we never got the pension.
So what does the son of a postal clerk and teacher decide to do for a living? What was your psychology after you graduated college of what you wanted to do with your life?
Somehow, I wanted to do something great, something along the lines of Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, Pasteur, you know, one of those people, Beethoven perhaps, you know. So with that kind of dream, when I was 10 years old, I happened to pick up a book of Sigmund Freud, and I didn't understand very much of it except that I understood that it was possible to really understand human behavior. And that seemed to me to be a very, very profound and suitable task. And I became a psychologist. In fact, I worked in a mental hospital, headed up a research project at the Massachusetts General Hospital and taught for 3 years at Boston University, all by the time I was 28. And then my adventures began.
And your first adventure was to Russia in 1955. What did you do in Russia, and why did it involve a camera?
Well, I had this passion, which has remained a very strong part of my interest, even now, a passion to portray ordinary people just as they are. We've always lacked that, and we lack that today. I don't know of any images that I've seen of Iraqis, just ordinary people. And so I got a tourist visa to go to Russia, a 30-day visa. Then I thought, okay, I'll bring my camera and get images of ordinary people. And since I knew so much about mental health, I would try to get into mental hospitals. A crazy idea because, you know, 1955, Soviet Union going to let an American into mental hospitals.
They're both in.
You'd have to be crazy to get into one. You know? I remember when I hitchhiked to New York to try to get funds from Life magazine or CBS. I traveled with an old friend of ours, and all I could afford was a very cheap hotel. And the two of us, as he was trying to sleep, I would wake up every hour or so, and I'd turn to Red, and I'd say, "What, do you think I'm crazy? I don't have any permission, and I'm going with a camera that I'm borrowing from CBS." And he, every hour he'd say, "Oh, don't worry, it's okay. You'll be okay." Finally, 4 o'clock in the morning, again, I wake him up, and he turns to me and says, "Al, you know, you're going on a lark." And it must have been at that moment that I must have smiled, because going on a lark is exactly what I do. It's a chancy thing, but I'm flying high.
And this is how you achieve greatness.
I think so.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or fancy film sets. Was there anything different about being in a Russian mental hospital than in a mental hospital that spoke English? Was there anything instrumental about that language barrier that was particularly striking to you in any way? Or?
Well, I try to get beyond the language barrier. And, of course, I was accompanied by the chief of psychiatry, so I wasn't being shown everything. But one thing that was quite different was that just about all the doctors were women. It sort of had a women's approach, which in some ways got beyond the politics. I had understood, and I know for sure, that there were many political prisoners who were sent to mental hospitals. I was not introduced to them, but I did get a closeness with people, and with my camera I was able to convey that. I brought back the material. I had a deal with CBS, where they would give me all the material eventually, and whatever they would use, they would pay me $1 a foot. So I made $14.
What was the state of technology at the time in the 1950s, 1960s, in terms of, you know, perhaps the sync between the audio and the picture? What did your camera look like?
Well, in 1955, the camera that I took with me was just a simple wind-up camera with reels of film that only ran for 3 minutes, and a noisy camera at that, but no sync sound, which surprised me a great deal. Nothing advanced to the point where you could really do a story spontaneously. You had to use a narrator to explain the stuff that you got on film. All that changed in 1960 when I met up with three other filmmakers, Bob Drew, Richard Leacock, and Don Pennybaker, and the four of us made a film that started a whole revolution in documentary filmmaking. The film was called Primary, and it was of the election campaign between Kennedy and Humphrey. We got behind the scenes and filmed exactly what their experience was.
So in a way, technology enabled you to be a direct cinema filmmaker.
Exactly. Well, once I met up with these guys, we all were mutually inspired and realized that we're into brand new territory that could change the world.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Al Maisels, the documentarian, and the New York Times in 2002 acknowledged Al as the dean of documentary filmmaking. You also were considered a pioneer in the fact that you made the first nonfiction feature film. How would you describe what a nonfiction feature film is?
Well, there have always been feature films that were fiction. Dramatic films that ran at least an hour and a half or so and were really made for the cinema. But documentary, maybe feature length, that is an hour long, but not really features. The big change came especially with Salesman, a film that we made in 1968. We made it with the expectation that it would get shown in movie theaters. When we finished it, none of the cinematic chains were interested in the film. They weren't as revolutionary as we were in our making of the film. But we figured out that we could start the ball rolling by renting a movie theater and showing it. So we showed the film to some 100 or so people at a screening right here in New York to raise money. And as people filed out, they once they'd seen the film, they congratulated my brother and me and Charlotte Zwerin, who edited it masterfully. And I noticed through a crack in the door that there was one person left in the theater. And as she got up to leave, she turned in our direction. I saw she'd been crying. Further, as she got closer, I saw how attractive she was. And I gave my brother the elbow and I said, "She's for me." That's how I met my wife.
Oh. What is your wife's name?
Her name is Jillian. Yeah, the best thing that ever happened to me. In a funny way, it's the best thing that ever happened to the main character of the film, Paul, who's a tragic figure in that he's the most unsuccessful of the four salesmen. But he's unsuccessful because he has that much more poetry in his makeup, that much more humanity. He saw the film with us opening night, and sitting next to me, he cried at the right time. He laughed at the right time. It was his opportunity to be recognized for what he is.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, one of the creators of the nonfiction feature film. We'll hear more from Albert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, the founder of Maisels Films, a documentary film company. He was one of the creators, along with his brother David, of the modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. And direct cinema is a way of capturing reality as life unfolds on camera without the use of narration or scripts or film sets. Why don't we play some of Salesman? This is going to be the opening of the film, the first few minutes of the film.
The bestseller in the world is the Bible, for one reason. It's the greatest piece of literature of all time. It's really tremendous, isn't it?
And the shepherds and the three kings, flight into Egypt, the childhood of Jesus. Mary turns to Aaron, Mary finds Jesus in the temple.
Well, you can see how this would be an inspiration in the home. You like that, honey? What's her name?
Christine.
Well, she's as bright. She's pretty like a mother, huh? Christine, you know what my name is?
Yes.
Paul. Paul, you know?
Paul? You have a cousin named Paul, don't you, Chris?
You can see how complete it is.
The Bible runs as little as $49.95. And we have three plans on it. Cash, COD, and also they have a little Catholic honor plan.
Which plan would be the best for you, the A, B, or C?
I'm really not interested in once I speak it over my husband.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to give him a surprise. Does he have a birthday coming up? Your lovely gift.
That's true.
We place a tremendous... The Bible is still the best seller in the world, so...
I just couldn't afford it now. We were small with medical bills.
interesting, you know, the little girl goes over to the piano and plays a little tune, totally spontaneously, something she'd made up at the moment, I would suppose, right? Every time I see that and hear that music, I think, oh my goodness, Beethoven couldn't have done any better. It was so appropriate to that moment. Mm-hmm. Now, documentaries up to that time, and even now, you know, they depend on a musical score by a composer. But this was an inherent part of it. This little child, on her own, expressed so beautifully what's going on in Paul's mind without even thinking of it that way.
In a way, spontaneity worked so well for you, you know, in this moment. And that happens to be the case often for you in your films, as you rely so much on spontaneity. Does it ever disappoint? Is there ever a time when nothing happens? Or how often does nothing happen when you want it to?
You just have to wait it out. It'll happen. Spontaneity for me is it has to happen on its own for it to be true. And so when we make a film, we exercise no controls over people, what's going on. That would distort the nature of what's happening. It's chancy. I like to say that we take a chance when we have a child. Who knows what's going to happen?
Another example of sort of spontaneity in your films is a film that you've been working on for decades called In Transit.
Yes.
At first, I think it was called Fellow Passengers and then Train Stories, and now it's called In Transit. What's that about?
I might even change the title to Going on a Lark, because that's what it is. I get on long-distance trains in half a dozen countries of completely different cultures all around the world. And by chance, I expect that as I walk through each one of these trains, a 2 or 3 day trip for each train, I'll find somebody where there's a story about to take place when they get off the train. And I see somebody who looks a little bit nervous. Something seems to be going on, and I'll chat with them and be filming even at that time. People, as I have discovered, would like to express themselves filmically if they can trust the person behind the camera. And somehow people trust me when they see me, and how I look at them, they look back at me in a trusting fashion. I know it's okay.
Why do you think that is, Albert?
I think because I really like people. And even if it's somebody that I might not particularly care for initially, I'll discover things that I like about them. And I also would like to have this heartfelt feeling that it's very important that people be represented for who they are. And sometimes something a little bit embarrassing. But when that person sees it later on, they say, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's right. It's true.
There's one scene that I've heard of a woman you've met on the train in Pennsylvania. Could you tell that story?
The train is just leaving the Pittsburgh station, and I walk through the train. I see a woman. It looks kind of nervous. Something's going on. She's sitting at an empty table in the cafeteria coach. Sitting across from her is her little child. There I am with it. At that time, a big camera on my shoulder and a sound person next to me. And I ask her if I might join her and maybe do some filming. I'm making a film of people I meet on trains. She said, oh, please. So I began filming. And right away, she told me why she was on the train. When she was 3.5 years old, her parents broke up in an ugly divorce. And her father getting custodianship over her and vowing that her mother would never see her again. She's never seen her mother since she was 3. The night before she got on the train, she got a call from a woman in Philadelphia saying, get on the next train. I'll be waiting for you at the train station. And so when she got off the train, I kept filming. As she began climbing the stairs, a woman at the top of the stairs flung open her arms, rushed down the stairs. And there I filmed the whole encounter, ending with her mother turning to me and saying, isn't she gorgeous?
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or fancy film sets. And your brother, David, was an integral part of your life professionally, and he passed away in what year?
1987.
How did he die?
He had a mild heart attack and got so depressed that he took some sort of medication with the warning that he shouldn't take Alka-Seltzer or, I think, red wine or something like that. And he mistakenly took one of those things, and that was the end.
And how did that affect your work? Because he obviously was working with you very closely.
Well, there was a young woman, Susan Fromke, who had been working with us for many years. And she took over David's role beautifully. And we continued to make films. We made a wonderful film, which she helped in the editing process, a film called Grey Gardens. Showing in various forms today. There's a Broadway musical based on it.
What is Grey Gardens about?
It's about two women, the mother 80 or so and the daughter 60. They're Bouviers, so they're from American aristocracy. But for 20 years, they'd been living alone in this decaying old mansion in the Hamptons. Born of American aristocracy, they couldn't quite lived the way they wanted to. Mother wanted to be a singer, the daughter of a dancer. And so they chose this life as recluses. They lived with so many cats and raccoons, and the whole house was kind of falling apart at that time.
Were they at all averse to providing you access to their lives at all?
Nothing better could have happened to them. They relished the whole idea of just being themselves. Eccentrics that they were, they were extremely entertaining, just filming them with their conversations with themselves. Really, it was a love affair, really, between mother and daughter, so intense that the daughter could never leave the house. And so it was good and not so good for both of them, but mostly good.
Have you ever had this sort of visceral desire to get involved in the lives of any people that you film because you think they're going down a wrong path? Or
I see. Well, my engagement is my disengagement. That is, I don't interfere in any way with what's going on, but I'm engaged in recognizing them and in capturing them exactly as they are. When the mother in Grey Gardens, when she was dying, her daughter turned to her, as she told me at that moment. She turned to her and said, "Is there something more that you want to say?" And her mother responded, "There's nothing more to say. It's all in the film."
You are now a father of how many children?
Four children.
How did they come to understand what their father did for a living?
Oh, well, without any purpose in mind except to entertain my kids, when they were old enough to understand a story, I would tell them stories from my own childhood. For example, I remember telling them how in the 1930s it was the custom for the father of the family to take the strap to the child when the child misbehaved. And my father had a strap, but he would never use a strap on me, except that once I must have done something terribly bad. I don't remember what it was. And he took the strap to me. And I think he struck me only once. It didn't even hurt. I didn't think anything of it. Until a few moments later, I happened to walk through the apartment. When I came into his bedroom and crossed to the other side and turned back, and there was my father with the head against the wall crying. I stood there in total amazement, taking in this extraordinary feeling of his love for me. In all those years that went on after that, could have told me how much he loved me. It wouldn't have been quite as strong, had a strong effect as that moment.
Are there ever times when you feel frustrated because you wish you had captured a piece of reality on camera and you missed it?
Oh, yes. There have been times now when I certainly should carry a camera with me all the time.
What's an example of?
I was on a bus not so long ago. And across from me was a very much overweight black woman. And as she sat there just looking off into space, nothing was happening, but I felt some kind of anticipation of something might take place. So I nudged the woman next to me. Now the two of us, in a very kindly fashion, were looking at her. At that moment, the little girl next to her, maybe 7 or 8, got up, slipped around in front of her mother, and nestled her head between her mother's enormous breasts and fell asleep. From nothing, it just turned into a beautiful act of mother-child relationship, and should have been filming.
You have made over 36 films, and we talked a little bit about, you know, whether it's Primary or Salesman or Grey Gardens, and I could go on. You've had access to Truman Capote and Marlon Brando and the Christos, who wrapped Central Park in these orange flags. How have you gotten access to these people, or how did you get access to these people very early on, like the Rolling Stones, for instance, in 1970?
It's all by happenstance, and it's different in each case. In 1964, I remember sitting at my desk answering the phone. It was the Granada Television from England calling, saying that the Beatles are arriving in 2 hours in New York. Would you like to make a film of them? I put my hand over the phone and turned to my brother and said, "Who are the Beatles? Are they any good?" My brother fortunately knew, and with a big smile on his face, he got on the phone. And we made a deal right away, rushed out to the airport just as the plane was coming down. 6 days later, we had the best film of the Beatles. Filmed as we had learned to make it, you know, totally spontaneous. You really felt, perhaps, that you were the fifth Beatle.
Going back to this access, you've had access to the Dalai Lama. What is a moment from that experience that you remember?
This was just a couple of years ago when the Dalai Lama came to New York to address many thousands of people in Central Park. When you ask for a gray moment, that took place in a hotel where the Dalai Lama was staying. 5 o'clock in the morning, I was with him filming his meditation. It's one of the most powerful, memorable experiences for me as a person and for anybody who will see it. I've met people like that. Reverend Desmond Tutu, for example, he is of that ilk. And they must be represented in documentary. But then I would go all the way in the other direction, too. It's so important that we get to know ordinary people. I'm reminded of an experience that I had when my daughter, who is now 30, when she was 4 years old, there were times in the evening, maybe 10 o'clock in the evening, the two of us would go off down the street to the newsstand to pick up the New York Times for the next day. And so one day, one evening, we went to the newsstand and the paper hadn't arrived yet. And I was getting a little bit nervous. And she turned to me and said, "Daddy, the paper's not finished yet because the people haven't been killed yet." And that has inspired me to film other kinds of events other than violence and killing and so forth, and try to find, as the Dalai Lama does, to find routes to happiness.
You're considered one of the pioneers of direct cinema, where everything happens ad hoc and you're kind of just watching things unfold naturally without your having any agency.
That's right.
But was there a time before you got to that process where you were doing the traditional interviews?
Yes. Between 1955 and 1960, before we had the equipment and the philosophy, we would film in more traditional fashion.
What's an example of that?
Well, when we were in Poland at the time of the revolution there, 1956-57, we would attend a protest, for example, and interview some of the students who were protesting. They were protesting against the banning of their newspaper by the government. And in fact, I remember during the protest, the police didn't know who I was. They thought I was a protester, and they hit me on the head. I got badly bruised below one of my eyes. But right away, I told them in the broken Polish that I was American, and they stopped. And that evening, I met up with a Polish friend that I had recently met. And he said, "You know, Maisels, you and your brother, you know so much better than so many other Americans coming here what's going on here in Poland. You can appreciate it. But now, having been hit on the head, now you know exactly what it's like.
Was there any film that was a turning point for you financially at all? Let's talk about that issue.
Actually, when I think of the three most outstanding films that we've made, Gimme Shelter, Salesman, and Grey Gardens, Salesman certainly haven't made their money back yet. For one thing, it took over 30 years for Salesman to get on television at all, and 25 years for Grey Gardens. Gimme Shelter, we probably have begun to make a profit. It's a tough profession.
You've just moved to Harlem from where? Where were you living before you were
living
in Harlem?
In the Dakota building where John Lennon lived.
How does a documentarian live in the Dakota?
You marry the right person.
I just want it to be on the record that in your clothes, you have a name tag on every single garment. Why do you have name tags on all of your clothes, even into your 80s?
When I was a child, I had the dream of going to summer camp, like all the other kids, but we could never afford that. And what I liked about it so much was you had to have a name tag on all your clothes when you go to summer camp. So all my clothes have name tags. I sew them on myself, whether it's my shirt or my underpants or my jacket, whatever it is, or coat.
Thank you very much for joining us, Albert.
It's expired. That was an hour? That was fast. Yeah, good.
My guest has been Albert Maysles, the famed documentary filmmaker. If you're interested in any of his films or to learn more about Albert, you could go to his website at mayslesfilms.com.
Right, that's it.
You don't need the www. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with a pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank. And in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before.
The founder of McDonald's.
But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways, because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Eunice Count's plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameenbank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back and he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen, and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him, or were you like, yeah, of course, it's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me. And I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman. And so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do at addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye, that I could do it. And, of course, that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus, and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I've been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year? Things that surprised you?
Yeah.
Things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job, because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn $40 or a $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is, around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize. But while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest. And he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So, like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I had just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period, like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like 6 or 7 staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for 3-4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000, I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million by the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated. I was, you know, barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board, and we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's one guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal, and I got up my courage to ask him to help me, and he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important, for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more. Yeah. And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital. And it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So that planted a seed of, my God, we're on to something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Kleiner Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years, where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than 1 million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, you know, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together, and it was so improbable. We weren't on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning, and yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and one of my board members really took up the leadership role I play. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these, you know, 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule. But they kind of scared him, and from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi, in Bangladesh, which was the name of the village. And yet when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women. And they began to socialize more and establish, you know, bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I'd lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
If you look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers, and of the rest, it's anywhere between 50-90%. Microlending and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate. And if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. the man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, they bring the other women bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible, and I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.